Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
All right. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
No, I'm doing great, man.
Awesome. I have a quick update from our Sandra Bland episode. I need to do a correction. After we spoke about Sandra, I wanted to bring up a example of law enforcement doing the right thing. And I brought up the main officer that pulled over a man, and the man was berating the officer, and the officer was cool and, you know, whatever. Well, it was brought to my attention that that officer actually might have tampered with the camera and only started recording after he had already agitated the driver. And then once the driver was berating him, he behaved as if he was taking it. It sounds like he had multiple complaints against him, and he was trying to prove that he was okay with the public and he was a good officer. So he kind of fabricated the video, which, man, I didn't question or research the video because it was my ace in the hole of this is a perfect example of a cop doing the right thing. And I might have got that wrong. It's kind of sucks and it's sad because I feel like now all of a sudden that whole episode is very lopsided against law enforcement, and that was not my intention by any means. So I have to find another good officer to point out. And the police officer that wrote to us and told us about this other Maine police officer, I know he didn't want us to use his name. You're the good officer because you pointed out a mistake that one of another police officer made, and that's all we really want is honesty and fairness. And when there is a bad apple messing up, we would like it pointed out, and we would like other officers to point it out. So you did that today. So hey, you are the hero officer, and you are the guy that I would buy a beer because you pointed out that this officer wasn't one of the good guys, even though I thought he was. So interesting plot twist there.
Yeah, the other note is I did an interview last week, sort of an impromptu thing, came together rather quickly, but Mike Carruthers of Perfect Your Podcast, he contacted me and wanted to interview me about Justin and I's show. And so if you want to listen, you can go to perfectyourpodcast.com. It's episode number 3. And it's also on iTunes if you'd rather get it there.
Oh, and I'm almost all the way through the Maura Murray podcast, the Maura Murray documentary one. So enjoying it. So what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight is all about Amelia Earhart.
This is our second attempt at this episode. We had some issues on the first one, so I think this one's going to be so much better.
And she is probably the most famous female aviator in history. I mean, we can't even think of another one, can we?
No, I can't, sadly. So when was she alive? When?
Well, this would be from 1897 through 1937, I believe.
Yes. And she was born in Atchison, Kansas. Her parents moved to Kansas City, Kansas, or KCK, we like to call it. But she ended up staying with her grandparents back in Atchison. And as a little girl, a little rebellious and very independent, her grandparents were fairly old school, and that just didn't gel well with her. So eventually she ends up navigating, flying around the planet at the equator, and she ends up disappearing. So at that point, a lot of speculation, a lot of theories, a lot of issues with what happened to the most famous woman in the world at that time. There's so many crazy stories out there. There's that she crashed on this small abandoned island that was 200 miles away from where she was supposed to be. The Japanese captured her and used her as a propaganda device. All the way to alien abduction, or something as simple as her and her navigator took off and lived a secret life. I think by the end of the episode, you probably will understand that some of these ideas and theories might be a little more far-fetched, and sometimes our heroes go down in a very non-spectacular way.
Spoiler alert.
Like I was saying, as a child, she was, she rebelled against the norm. She would ride a bicycle, and girls were not supposed to do that. She would jump fences in her dress. She would pretty much do anything and everything she could to not be ladylike and to, the disapproval of her parents and grandparents.
But was it so much that she was rebelling, or is perhaps she's just doing things she enjoyed.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's sad when it's a form of rebellion when you're just doing things that you enjoy, but society or your family feels is taboo. But, it, you know, in today's culture and world, these things are so minuscule compared to what's considered taboo today. It was said that she liked to play with bugs and bones even when she was a child. Not that, you know, she was a murderer, serial killer in training. She was just a, you know, more of the tomboyish. And they actually gave her a nickname of Dr. Bones because she was rearranging and trying to reconfigure horse bones back into a shape of a horse or whatever. I'm sure that, you know, that was very unladylike. But she goes on to play football and soccer and other sports. And then she moves back. I guess she's at this point, she's kind of visiting her parents on the summers and living with her grandparents. But she's growing up and she's kind of the kingpin of her group, of her friends, and she's the leader. I think that kind of sets the personality and the stage up for a woman that ends up breaking records later on in life.
Yeah, she stays with her grandparents basically to go to school in Atchison, and her grandparents had a much nicer place to stay at, mm-hmm. whereas her parents, they didn't really have as nice a place to live in because her father would move for work. So when you look to see where they've lived, they've sort of lived in all kinds of places because he would just go and find work and then they would move there. The reason her dad had to move so much is because he developed a drinking problem. And I don't know for certain, but I got the feeling that the reason why he started drinking was because of his job.
Yeah.
He was a lawyer. I could imagine it being stressful, and sometimes your habits become your bad habits, become your crutches, and this sort of contributed to her, because they move so much, she's probably very much like some military kids are. They're not really rooted in a spot. This would go on to affect the rest of her life, I think.
Yeah, I think they moved, her parents moved to Kansas City, Kansas, and then they moved up to like Des Moines, Iowa, and then back to Kansas City, Missouri. And that was something that I actually didn't know, was she's from the same city as us. So it was, she wanted to do her own thing. Something else that made me relate to her besides location is, it is said that she didn't go to her high school graduation and pick up her diploma. Neither did I. I graduated high school, but I didn't go and buy a cap and gown. I didn't go walk the stage because it didn't mean anything to me. I knew I graduated and that's all I cared about. Same with her. I had better things to do. So very practical sense of the world, I guess.
So after she moves, there's a point at which her parents are in Des Moines, Iowa, and she moves up there. And she ends up going to the state fair. And this is the first time she's been to one. And she sees an airplane there. And funny enough, she takes a look at this airplane and she doesn't think much of it. She thinks it looks pretty poor, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like I said, her father was an alcoholic. And this ended up causing a problem between he and his wife. So Amelia's mother leaves him. Let's kind of go over the family real quick. There's Amelia and there's her younger sister, Muriel. Mm-hmm. And the father is Edwin and the mother is Amy. Because of the alcoholism and because he's just not consistent, he can't keep a job. Amelia's mom takes the kids and moves to St. Paul, Minnesota. So this is in 1913. A few years later, Amelia is graduating high school. And she graduates high school in Chicago. So again, as we talk, she's all over the place.
Yeah, poor girl never really probably had any foundation or solid friendships back then.
I didn't go too deep into my reading on where she went to high school. I just understood that she chose the high school because she had an interest in science, and apparently they had a well-regarded science program there.
Yeah, and it seemed like anything she put her hands on or anything she put her mind to, she was really good at it. She was determined, you know. I mean, if she's called Dr. Bones as a child, I mean, it's she probably could have been a pathologist or, you know, one of the early archaeologists or something if she wanted to go that route. It's like she had so much potential.
There's also something that I found interesting, which is when she was a teenager, she kept a scrapbook and she would collect newspaper articles about women who had excelled, especially in fields where men were typically excelling, not women. She seemed to want to aspire to something great too. You could see that in the scrapbook. So sort of a
inspirational book or a role model book or something. Or?
She knows where she wants to go.
Yeah.
She wants to go up. She wants to do something great. In 1918, this is 10 years after she saw her first airplane. And remember, back then, airplanes were not common like they are today. So in 1918, she's with her friend.
At the Carnival State Fair or whatever. But when the air show's going on, her and her friend, either they're just not digging hanging out with the family or whatever, but they kind of go off to a little area by themselves to see the air show better, to have a better view.
Well, this stunt pilot is putting on a show and at some point dives at the crowd, not to take them out, of course, but just to do a flyover, make it thrilling for the audience. And Amelia's friend, she flees, she's freaked out, but Amelia stands her ground and just takes it in. And this is obviously the first moment where she's impressed and that the plane really strikes her.
Taken in by flight.
She's taken in by it. The love of flying, that's the seed right there, I believe, is in 1918. She goes in, she attempts to go into medicine. She does a year of pre-med at Columbia University, but she doesn't stick with it. And she ends up moving to Los Angeles, California, to live with her parents, who have now reunited.
Yeah, it was kind of a weird thing because her parents were probably going to get a divorce, but the grandparents had an inheritance and they had pretty much not a prenup, but rules or provisions that the husband or her father would not get the inheritance if they were to split up. I don't know all the finite details to it, but essentially it behooved him to stick around because he wouldn't get the money or he wouldn't get the properties.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements, I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts, and when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Well, in 1920, and by this point, Amelia is 23 years old, she and her father attend an air show on Long Beach. And there is, at the time, a very famous pilot by the name of Frank Hawks. He takes her for a ride in his airplane. Once she gets 200 or 300 feet off the ground, she says she knew she had to fly. So the experience was unlike, you could look back and say, well, the year pre-med, it wasn't doing anything for her. She probably could have done that, but it just, it wasn't big enough. It wasn't grand enough. It wasn't something that when you have a, you write down what your dreams are, pre-med is not on that. Not for her. She's thinking bigger.
I think she was just going with the flow of what most women did for work back then, which was take care of wounded soldiers. I think that was just the big popular kind of career thing then. So during World War One, she was helping the wounded soldiers that came back from the war, and a lot of them had a Spanish flu. During her time nursing them and assisting them, it said that she actually came down with the flu or got very sick herself, and that might come into play later. I don't really see her doing that as her dream either.
Well, the flight, she was up there for 10 minutes in the plane, and her dad had paid $10 for the flight, so not bad.
I heard that she loved the flight, and it's what sparked her interest in flying, but she thought the pilot was a little arrogant and possibly like just gruff or kind of not the most, she wouldn't want to learn from him.
Well, Frank Hawks had been in the Royal Flying Corps. This is something that's also very interesting. Even though she may have had a little issue with Frank and his ego, possibly, when she was volunteering at a military hospital, which was it was Toronto's Spadina Military Hospital, there was a man there by the name of Mr. Roger Anderson. And Anderson would tell her stories about the Royal Flying Corps, and she loved to hear stories about this group. So she had heard about this group, and then she ends up meeting one of the most famous guys from that group later on.
Yeah, and she doesn't ask him for flying lessons. She gets them from a woman.
The following year, she starts working different jobs because she needs money for flying lessons. Flying lessons, I think, were going to cost her about $1,000.
Yeah, I think she ended up spending like $2,000 altogether, which could have bought like 4 or 5 cars back then. I mean, it was just, she would have been better off as a photographer or some other outrageous hobby, but flying is not cheap.
Was working different jobs. Some of those jobs, like driving a gravel truck, again, not working very well with any of her family. They just frowned upon this and said, this is not something a young lady should be doing. And Amelia did not care what they thought. But the interesting thing is, since her mother had such an issue with some of these jobs she was working, she started to help her out with the money she needed so that she could get her flying lessons, so that she would quit working some of these jobs.
I could see that. Yeah. She doesn't... The jobs she's doing are dangerous, and to the point where it might screw up her dream if she were to get injured or whatever. So
she finds a pilot to help her, and it is a woman, and her name is Anita Snook. This is funny, but she really loves the look of the pilot, and female pilots would cut their hair a certain way, they would dress a certain way, and Amelia loved it. So she didn't have a worn leather jacket, you know, the classic worn leather jacket that these pilots would wear. So she actually would just sleep in her jacket, hoping it would mess it up a little bit. So it would look like it would have character.
It's kind of like how we wear faded jeans or torn up jeans today. You know, you can't have crisp jeans.
And she wanted her hair cropped short, like the other female pilots, but her mother did not want her to have boys' hair. So she planned this out. She started cutting her hair, but she only cut off so much at a time so that it was very gradual. It wasn't in one fell swoop. She didn't just cut it off one day. She actually took her time and cut it off a little here and there. And over time, she got to that look.
She's a chameleon.
Well, I think it's part of its survival. She really knows what she wants and she's heading towards it. And her family could trip her up. So she's doing the best she can, I think. But she's not giving up any of her dream, that's for sure. She gets help from her mother. This is about 6 months after she starts taking flying lessons from Anita Snook. She's got a job sorting mail at a telephone company. Again, because her mother doesn't want her working men's jobs, she needs to help Amelia out. And Amelia's next step is not just flying lessons. Now she wants a plane of her own.
Yeah. Yeah, she has to buy one.
So on July 21st of 1921, she buys her first plane. And it's a used Kenner Airster. And it was bright yellow. I've heard some people say she painted it. Mostly, though, I see that it was just yellow from the beginning. I couldn't tell you. I don't know. But it was nicknamed the Canary. And it had a range of 300 miles. Its top speed was 85 miles per hour. Its cruising speed was, I think, 70 or 75. And it had a 60 horsepower engine.
That's it.
And it topped out at 14,000 feet altitude. But it was her plane.
Yeah.
Now she had something that she could practice in and get used to. And these planes back then, this isn't a top-of-the-line plane.
I wouldn't get in this thing.
But you really had to control the plane.
Yeah.
There's nothing automated about it. Every little aspect has to be constantly controlled, from what I understand. But the following year, October 22nd, 1922, she sets a new altitude record of 14,000 feet.
It's as high as she can go in her little plane.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then because she's flying so much now, in 1923, she becomes the 16th woman to get her pilot's license, which that's something. I mean, I know she's not the first or the second one, but the 16th, I mean, come on, that's a big deal.
I find it interesting because there are 15 women before her. We don't know who they are, no. Right? I mean, we don't have a list of their names.
They're not in the newspapers, and they're not as famous as Amelia is today.
The only thing that tells me is that it comes down to her personality. Like we said before, she's got big dreams.
Yeah.
These other women probably may have even been better pilots for all we know, but they didn't make their mark.
No.
Not in the way that she had. So
I know that when she got her pilot's license, one of the tests they have to do for this is a dead stick landing where you're a mile up in the sky and you cut your engines and you have to land the plane with no engines. That's insane. Like that. I mean,
the FAA.
FAA, you know, that doesn't fly today. Yeah, that's what they would. That was one of the things they'd have to do back then. So that's scary. It wasn't easy to get your pilot's license. And once she had it, I think it didn't matter if it was a male or female pilot. They were all pretty much accepted in that group, because if you were, you know, a pilot, that means you had to go through some dangerous stuff to get there.
In 1928, there's going to be a planned flight across the Atlantic.
And she's going to be the first woman to, quote unquote, navigate the Atlantic.
Well, I don't know about navigate, because she's not flying the plane.
And this pisses her off to no end.
Well, I don't know if it pisses her off. I think she's, on one hand, she's probably thinking, why do I want to be on this if I'm not the pilot?
Yeah, I'm just the token woman sitting here. I think she refers to herself as a bag of potatoes. Yeah.
But I think it's still going to put her on the record books.
Yeah.
And I think that's what gets her on the plane.
True. But it doesn't go very well. The flight actually, they didn't plan the wait very well. And literally by the time they reach their destination, they're out of gas and they're just in a bad way. And they're in a pontoon plane and they rope off to a buoy and get rescued essentially. But by the time she hits land, she's a hit. She is on all the news, huge celebrations in the streets. This is a woman that is being celebrated for getting stuff done. Unlike Paris Hilton and Kim Kardashian of today, who are famous for being famous.
Many people may not know this, but a woman owned that plane.
Yeah.
Friendship was the name of the plane. And she wanted to be the woman on this flight, but her family did not want her on the flight. It became too much of a hassle for her to try and do this, but she still wanted a woman on that flight. And one of the people who was part of the group putting this together was a publisher by the name of George Putnam. Hmm. And he liked Amelia. And this is how Amelia gets asked to be on this flight. Now, of course, she has to agree. And she does. As we said, it's a success. And she gets very famous. Despite her saying, I didn't do anything. I was a
bag of potatoes.
A bag of potatoes keeping a logbook.
I think there was five other women that actually had attempted to cross the Atlantic before this. And a few of them were never found again. Nobody made it. So she was the first one to actually make it.
Yeah, the flight lasted 20 hours and 40 minutes. Well, George Putnam, who had already worked with Charles Lindbergh on a book, thought Amelia should have a book. And this book, 20 hours, 40 minutes. That's the title. And it's all about her flight across the Atlantic. I haven't read it. I don't know what she would say, but I'm sure it was a hit at the time.
Well, and back then, flying was the big thing. It was the Industrial Revolution. It was, we have accomplished something more now. Flight is still in its infancy. So anyone doing anything flying related is going to get name recognition right there.
So because George has worked with her on this book and he's helping to promote her, he becomes her manager, basically.
Yeah.
I don't know that they sit down and draw up forms, but they just start working together. George and Amelia are seen together a lot. So people start thinking, oh, maybe there's something going on here. But people that knew George and his wife were going in separate directions.
Yeah. And once they ended up separating, his wife was remarried within a month and George got with Amelia. So it was bound to happen. It was a mutual understanding, I think.
By 1929, he and his wife have divorced. Amelia enters a derby. It's the all-women's air derby, although that's not what it's famously known as. And she placed third, and there's criticism here because she had easily the fastest plane there.
But she was very sportsmanlike and carried luggage and loads from other pilots who had smaller planes and not enough room. So they kind of gave her like a handicap and they delayed pilots and stuff because she was overburdened with all the other pilot stuff, right?
So as I said, George and Amelia seem close and you might wonder, is this just a business relationship? What's the deal here? Well, apparently they had a lot in common. They both really love to do stuff, you know, outdoors, hiking and fishing and things like that. So they had things in common and they were both driven people.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you? And how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends, might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
So they sort of seemed like a good match. And of course, the rumors started that they were going to be married, and the press got in and started asking her questions. And I'm sure some of you have heard her famous line where she says, maybe sometime in the next 50 years, I'll be married. She ends up marrying George Putnam.
I'm sure they were in love and everything, but I wonder if the marriage was more of a media push.
Yeah, I didn't really see it as a media push because, again, they had things in common, and people that were in the family seemed to verify that when they were behind closed doors, they did act like husband and wife. But, and here's the interesting part, is the day of her wedding, she hands him a letter that tells him she can't really be locked down, that she may need time to just go away and do her thing. And that I think essentially she's saying, I may need time. I can't always be your wife. And I won't hold you to all of the duties that a husband would normally be held to. She's not getting married to be tied down. She's seeing enough good things out of this marriage that she's married, but
she's leaving it open, leaving an out.
This is not a traditional marriage, in other words.
Especially for the time. Definitely not a traditional marriage. I mean, even today, that's kind of looked down upon.
Yeah, she kept her last name, which I understand that. But it's her independent spirit, I think, that we should focus on the most when we talk about this, because I don't think she's being wishy-washy. I think she's just really independent.
No, she knows exactly what she wants. This right. is not wishy-washy.
She's going to get out what she wants out of it. And if it doesn't work out, she can just leave. Mm-hmm. She never wants to feel stuck, and she never wants to feel like she's not moving up. Yeah, she was into George. The primary thing is she was independent, and that overrode everything.
But George allowed her to live out her dreams. He was her agent, her manager, and he helped her, pushed her, PR circuits, the book, all these things, kind of to that next level, because he knew, well, she's the most famous woman in the world right now, so we have to manage this. Maybe to even his dismay, she would take it up another notch and say, well, we're going to do this now. And he wasn't always on board with all her decisions, but he was on board as her manager.
Yeah, they describe it as a partnership with dual control. One thing I was really happy to see, I think this is something that maybe everyone should consider doing, but when they said their vows, the word obey was omitted.
To love and obey?
No obey. She wasn't going to obey anyone but herself. So I like that. I don't think anybody should have to obey their partner. I think you do things out of love or respect.
My wife had it changed to husband and wife and not man and wife, because man and wife insinuates possession.
Yeah. So it's great that, you know, she's thinking about all this stuff. If you think back to the scrapbook and you see how her wedding went, this is someone who is very much not anti-man, just very pro-woman.
Yeah.
She wants women to do more and to strive for more. So you can see where she's already thinking about inspiring other people here. We went over how she was the first woman to fly across the Atlantic.
Yeah.
There are others that have tried. Mm-hmm. There are men that have tried that couldn't do it. Well, in 1932, she flies solo across the Atlantic.
This is for reals now. This is really her doing it.
Yes, she's doing it. She had a Lockheed Vega, which at the time was a very good plane. It took her 14 hours, 56 minutes, and she flew 2,026 miles. Not an easy flight, because she doesn't end up where she intended to go. She actually ends up in Ireland, I believe, instead of England.
But she still did it in less time than her first.
It's odd. Maybe it shouldn't be considered odd, but the press starts asking her about if she can bake, things like this. And you might think it's kind of insulting, especially this is a woman who is, she is not your regular one. This is someone who's aspiring for more, but she has sort of a sense of humor because she accepts the award on behalf of all women, even bakers. Now, she's most famous, though, because at some point she's going to announce to the world that she wants to take a flight around the world. And not just around the world, because men have done it. She wants to take a flight that goes around the equator, mm-hmm. which is a much greater distance than if she had flown up much higher to the north or to the south. There's a man by the name of Wiley Post, who was the first pilot to fly solo around the world. And to give you an idea about the difference here, the trip that he took was 15,474 miles in June of 1931. That took him 8 days, 16 hours. He did it again solo, because the first time he had a navigator. The second time he did it solo in 7 days, 19 hours. So you don't know if perhaps the weight difference, not having another body on there, perhaps helps. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, it's not just another body. It's the food and supplies for that person also.
Yeah, it's true. And this is something that people may not know about, but they should, because he had a friend who was very, very famous at the time, Will Rogers.
Oh.
Yeah. And he and Will Rogers decided to fly to Alaska, and they crashed and died in Alaska. And that's because the tanks aboard the plane, the way I understand it, weren't checked properly. So it created an imbalance, because some of the tanks in, I think, the front had emptied, and then the ones toward the back were full. And so the plane, there was no way it was going to take off the way they thought it was. Mm-hmm. And it crashed, and they both died. So Will Rogers, Wiley Post.
Fail.
They didn't make it.
So as much as Putman is her manager and keeping her on a tight schedule with everything, she wants to up the ante, and she wants to navigate the Earth herself around the equator. And he's cool with it, but not on board, really. In fact, I think at one point he says he wants to go with her, and she says no. She said she would rather have 180 pounds of fuel on the plane than him. Because he would be kind of useless. And I just think of the logistical nightmare of planning this trip out. I mean, just imagine planning a trip around the world on commercial airlines and landing at airports and just seeing the sights and then finally making it home. It's crazy. Now you think back then, where there weren't even airports at half the places she was landing. She had to make sure that there was food and supplies where she was landing. I don't even know how this was possible for her, but she planned it all out. I'm sure it took months, if not years.
Well, actually, they announced it, what, in 1936, correct?
Yeah.
And then in 1937 is when they attempt, but they had to contact about 20 different countries.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge distance here. We said before the Wiley Post did it, and it was 15,000 some odd miles, but that was not at the equator. At the equator, you're talking a huge distance, which is, what is that, probably close to double that, isn't it?
It's 29,000 miles around the Earth at the equator, so you were right. It's about double on the from the other guy's flight path. They actually modified her plane, correct? They took out everything in the hull of the plane and replaced it with gas tanks or a big gas tank. So she would have enough fuel to get from some of the long stretches on along her her path. She had to find a navigator too.
Well, the plane is a Lockheed Electra, mm-hmm. which at the time was the first all-metal plane and was pretty advanced. Her first navigator?
Harry Manning is very world-renowned as a great navigator, but he doesn't end up being her navigator for her flight. What happens there?
Well, early on, they try to take off from Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, I think it's Pearl Harbor, yeah.
And she has an accident where it's either she screwed up or the tire blew or the landing gear suffered a problem. Either way, I think it spooks him because, remember, she may be holding quite a number of records at this point and people know who she is, but that doesn't mean that all the other pilots out there, especially these men, are that confident in her. Mm-hmm. And this may be a sign that, yeah, maybe I don't want to be on this big flight. This has never been done by anybody successfully, not around the equator. So,
yeah, they were supposed to take off from Hawaii and pinpoint an island, but they're supposed to take off from there. Landing gear crushes during takeoff. Pretty much Manning's like, I don't think this is for me, because that's right off the bat. They have a wreck. The airplane's put on a boat, taken back to California to be repaired, and they literally reverse their entire trip. So instead of going from the West Coast or even Hawaii across Asia, instead they go across America and go the opposite direction.
Well, as your plans change and your dates change, they're checking weather. So I think that the headwinds and things like that affect the trip. So yeah. Once the trip has to be moved a little bit, then they just move the whole flight path.
So Manning doesn't want to go, so she has to find a new navigator for this second attempt. And what is his name?
Well, Fred Noonan, and he had left Pan American because he has a drinking problem, which this seems familiar.
Mm-hmm.
But he's supposedly a very, very good navigator, but he's old school, where Manning knew the new equipment and knew how to use a radio. Noonan really doesn't know that stuff. He's old school. He uses the stars and things like that.
And I could see why that might appeal to Amelia, because she's kind of old school also when it comes to her piloting.
Yeah, she's old school. She doesn't know anything about radio or Morse or any of, you know, anything that could assist her, you could say, the modern equipment.
It's so weird that Morse code was the modern equipment.
Well, it's just something else they could use.
Now they've taken the most treacherous part of their trip that was going to be the beginning, and they've switched it around to the end. If you're tired, if you're, you know, the sun's in your eyes, if you have this chain of events that's just working against you, it's going to cause a lot more problems than if you were fresh and having to deal with a hard part of this journey. So I think it's a mistake to reverse the entire trip, but hey, I wasn't there to give him advice, right?
Every time she takes off from somewhere, she has her plane loaded down with fuel, and then she can make it a certain distance, and she has to calculate what kind of headwinds she may be facing, and that determines where she can go. So if she knows she can fly for 10 hours, say, then she can choose some place that's 10 hours ahead that they've cleared, where they can land and get supplies and rest or whatever. But this is a complicated thing because you're traveling sometimes over land where the weather is probably more predictable. But then once you're flying over the ocean, especially the Pacific, the weather is less predictable. So she had done extensive tests to see what would happen with her fuel given different headwinds, different altitudes, how much she, when she had to really run the engine to climb. So she had an idea of how much fuel she'd have and how long she could go given the conditions that were predicted.
Which is astounding, because She didn't have Doppler radars back then. She didn't have built-in GPS. She barely would have even ground contact to ask, what's the weather like? So this is really, really by the seat of her pants.
Well, she can contact people and get their prediction on what the weather's going to be like, but this is just something that maybe works most of the time, yeah. But you can't say it's guaranteed.
While they're on their flight around the world, they're landing in different places, and it's said that Noonan is going on binges on some of their little weekend passes that they're going on, where, you know, escaping from their trip. She's giving updates about her trip. She's keeping journal entries and whatnot. And it is said that at some point along their trip, they might not be getting along so well. And it could be because he's drinking and she's already had an alcoholic father in her life. It's, you know, the environment. She's in this metal plane. So when it's hot, it's really hot. They don't have air conditioning in here. You crack a window if you need air. They don't have, if it's raining or hailing, it's just loud. She has a funnel and she's wearing men's underwear so she can relieve herself. Noonan's actually about, they say he's like 10 feet back and he's got this stick, this long stick that he'll put notes on. And that's how he passes the notes up to her, because the fuel tank's essentially in between the two of them. So she has to reach back and grab notes off a stick, write a reply. They can't hear each other because he's so far away. She's also, it's said that after the Spanish flu and after she was doing her nursing and helping wounded soldiers, that her sinuses and all that were never right again. And I don't know if it was actually the Spanish flu that had anything to do with it, or she just was born with bad sinuses, but I can't imagine being in an airplane, a hot, miserable, uncomfortable airplane for that long and getting along with anybody, really.
Yeah, on the flights, she didn't seem to want to take too much food. And it's because she apparently had stomach issues. So she would bring water, tomato juice, or hot chocolate. Well, it's just interesting to note that the 1 in 100 chance that the mechanic gave.
Oh, yeah.
That's just going across the Atlantic. So
yeah.
Think about that. You're going from 2,000 some hundred miles to 29,000 miles. So she had a 1 in 100 chance.
But she makes it all the way pretty much around the world.
Yeah, it's almost three quarters of the trip, I guess.
Yeah. So where's her her final stop? Is in New Guinea, isn't that?
Yes, in Ley, New Guinea. Mm-hmm. And New Guinea is interesting because the island is actually set up very well for planes. They have to ship things in and out. So that's not the difficult part. Getting there, New Guinea's not the problem. Yeah. The problem is their next stop after New Guinea is Howland Island. Howland Island is not very large.
2 miles long, half mile wide.
It's very, very small. So what they do is they station a ship that can help guide her in. And what they do is they can monitor the radio. And as she's getting closer, they can help guide her in because, you know, her voice will become louder and clearer as she gets closer to Howland Island. Now, depending on your altitude, Howland Island is either not so easy to find or almost impossible to find.
It's smaller than an airport.
So she's up there in the altitude, but then a storm comes in.
Now there's cloud cover. What do you do with that?
So she has to go below. Now she has to go down to 1,000 feet, which if you're only 1,000 feet up, you're not going to find Howland Island so easy.
No, because the higher you are, the more, I mean, it's simple. You know, if you're in a car driving down the road and you're seated up higher, like in a truck, you have better visuals than if you're in a low riding sports car. She knows that this last leg is the most treacherous. They have a boat helping them. She probably would have been better off with just having an aircraft carrier out there and just landing on it as opposed to landing on this island, but it'll work. And that's kind of the in-between point between New Guinea and Hawaii.
So she's flying towards Howland Island, but there are some factors coming into play that are going to hurt her trip here. And that is, she left behind some equipment because both she and Fred Noonan weren't familiar with the equipment. They didn't really know how to work it anyway. So she left her trailing wire antenna behind and her Morse code equipment behind.
It added extra weight, according to them, and it was just wasted.
It was wasted because they didn't know what to do with it anyway. Yeah. So if they knew how to use it, I think they would have kept it. It becomes dead weight when they don't know what they're doing with it anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think some would call into question leaving that stuff behind, but that's the choice they made. She ends up reporting that the headwinds are much stronger than she had anticipated. So as we talked about earlier, if she's flying and the winds are 12 miles per hour, then her calculated fuel consumption will be fine, and she'll probably be able to land on Howland Island no problem. But if it's over twice the amount,
it's just eating the gas.
It will reduce the amount of fuel she has more quickly. Now she's going to run out of fuel before she had planned to run out of fuel.
There's nothing out here except Howland Island, and then there's another island that's, I think it's like 20, 30 miles. I think it's like 20 miles south.
Oh, because I was reading that other than Howland Island, there was nothing for 325 miles, but maybe
you can't land on this other island.
Oh, okay.
It's just a tiny little rock in the ocean. And typically, when you're trying to find an island out in the middle of nowhere, you would, and there's two next to each other, Howland Island and this other island, you would aim in between them. So Noonan, as a experienced navigator, would have probably told her turn right or veer right a little bit or veer east by a few degrees, and that should take us in between the islands, and therefore you have two landmarks to spot as opposed to one flying straight to Howland Island. Now, between the uncomfortableness of the cockpit, between the headwinds, it's very possible that Amelia said, we just got to go straight there. We can't veer right and spot check landmarks and then circle back around. We just got to go straight to this island and land. It's a possibility there. It's what some people theorize was an argument happening on the airplane between Noonan saying, veer right, and Amelia saying, no, I'm going to go straight to the island.
So there's this ship at Howland Island named the Itasca. Mm-hmm. There's a man by the name of Leo Bellarts, and he's the one that's supposed to be communicating with Amelia Earhart, and he can hear her. But there's some issues here. Amelia doesn't really know how to operate her radio, so her voice is going out. But then on the other hand, Bellarts' radio, the frequency that Amelia is tuned into, she cannot receive a signal from Bellarts because Bellarts' outgoing signal is at a frequency that won't transmit voice, so she wouldn't get it anyway.
So she's talking, but they're hearing her, but she's not hearing them.
Yeah, she's letting them know what's going on with her and what kind of conditions she's facing. And so she's giving updates, and that's to let them know where she's at. So even if she can't hear them, she's hoping that they are picking her up and can at least verify, oh yeah, she's on the right path. So I don't know how good that is, but it's something. And according to Bellarts, she is coming in clearer and louder. So she's coming closer. And at some point, he actually gets up and heads out so he can look for her because he feels like she's getting really close. And Amelia had stated that she felt she was almost on them. So she was expecting to be able to find Howland Island 2 very soon.
But she doesn't come across it.
Yeah, not that we know of. And Bellart never sees her. And he closes his eyes and tries to listen. And he doesn't hear her either, which surprises him because he has like a rating scale from 1 to 5. The rating he was giving her meant that she should have been pretty close.
Between 20 and 30 miles away is...
Her last broadcast, the last thing she says, this is the morning of July 2nd, 1937. And at 7:42, she's speaking to them. She's using the radio and she says, "We must be on you, but cannot see you. But gas is running low. Been unable to reach you by radio. Calling Itasca. We are circling, but cannot hear you." This is kind of eerie because that's at 7:42. By 8:43, she sounds worried, very worried. And she says, "We are on the line at 157, 337. We will repeat message. We will repeat. We are running on line north and south." The Coast Guard is. They're trying different frequencies. They're trying to reach her so that maybe she would call back in and say, "Oh, I hear you now." Mm-hmm. But it's not working.
It's almost like she's getting colder and colder, like getting further away.
I don't know. I think what happens is they're flying back and forth in a pattern, mm-hmm, to hopefully run across and see one of the landmarks, like you said.
Yeah, whether it be Howland Island or Baker Island.
So because she had run into headwinds that were much stronger, and because of the cloud cover and stuff, and she had to gun her engines more than she had anticipated, her fuel is not going to last her as long as she had calculated. They feel as though that was the last broadcast. They feel like that may have been it. They don't hear from her again, and they react quickly. They send out ships and they sort of calculate where they think she may have gotten to, because they did feel as though she was close. So they send ships off in certain directions to look for her, and they don't find anything.
They have a massive search and rescue mission for her, because this is, you know, the number one woman in the world right now. She is the most famous woman. She is, you know, if there's any possibility of rescue, they're going to try to make it happen. And they end up searching about the size of Texas over there with rescue boats and ships. And I think they sent out pretty much most of the Navy and multiple airplanes.
It was 10 ships and 65 airplanes.
Yeah.
Which was, I believe, the largest search ever conducted at the time.
It was so costly that the President of the United States was actually criticized for it during the campaigns.
Well, she had helped the President campaign, did she not?
Yeah. So here we are. She's gone. I don't understand how aliens really is factored into this. I don't even understand how a Japanese capturing her. I mean, did she happen to come down next to a Japanese freighter?
Well, if they miscalculated how far away she was, if she landed at another island, it could have been an island where a Japanese ship could have come by and noticed. But this is, again, it depends on how much stock you put into the reports here. There's Bellart's testimony, what he says. He felt that she was very close. And there's also something called the Chater Report, which outlined exactly what kind of fuel consumption was likely happening and kind of gave you an idea of what's likely here. So, again, we said it's a huge distance between Howland Island and anything else that she could have landed on.
Yeah.
So if you go by that report, it seems to put her either, since she didn't land on Howland Island, it seems to put her in the water.
Because the other island was way south. So if she didn't veer right the way Noonan might have taken her in between Baker and Howland, then she would have continued straight, which is more north. And I just can't believe that she would have enough fuel to zigzag down 200-300 miles to get to the Gardner Island, which I'm not even going to try to pronounce the Japanese name because I'll butcher it. But that's one of the theories. But it's so far away, it just doesn't make sense. I know that they say they found items on that island, like a pocket watch. And
they found a woman's leather shoe, mm-hmm. but it was the wrong size. It was two sizes too big. So that it doesn't fit, although the date of it fits, you know, it's mm-hmm. a 1930s shoe, but it's too big. And then they also found a skeleton, which appeared to be a female skeleton, but they didn't have any conclusive evidence after testing it that would show that it was Amelia Earhart's skeleton.
Yeah. So I know people want to believe that one, but at the same time, people want to believe that their hero went down in a blaze of glory as opposed to horribly crashing into the ocean. I don't see any other way this goes. If the Japanese actually captured her, they would have bragged about it, or they would have just given her back and used her as a bargaining token. I don't see that. And the chances of her just happening across a Japanese freighter, and somehow this Japanese freighter not even being seen by the huge rescue effort, it just doesn't gel for me.
You say that people don't want to think that she just crashed, that she's this hero. She's above everyone. We didn't set records on a plane, right? I mean, mm-hmm. she did things that were amazing back then, but you have to kind of understand the risks that were involved in this. She made it clear. She had a letter that she left with George, and it basically said that she understood the risks, but that wasn't going to stop her. She'd rather have a big risky life than a quiet, safe one.
Well, it's like our astronauts today, or firemen, or anyone that puts themselves in harm's way. They're no less a hero. They're no less an idol or anything. They still are doing what they love, and it is quite possible that they will die doing what they love. And she's no different. I remember when the Challenger exploded when I was a little kid, and you know, that's just the way they went, and it's sad state of affairs. And I don't think Amelia Earhart went in any other way besides error in navigation and a terrible accident, wreck.
When I was researching this, I noticed that some people throughout history had criticized her for not flying often enough, because she would often fly on weekends, whereas other pilots would fly every day, or mostly every day. But to me, it wasn't about whether she was the best pilot. It was about she was the most ambitious pilot. She knew enough. She knew how to fly a plane, and she knew how to test the plane to see how to prepare for these long flights. I think that is evident in the way that she was able to fly solo across the Atlantic.
Yeah,
I don't think she did that by accident.
No.
You can say there's a little luck involved, but enough other people have died. I think what they were saying was in between her flight and Charles Lindbergh's flight, which was, I think, in 1927 when he went across the Atlantic. I think 14 different people had died in the meantime.
Oh, my gosh.
So not safe. And again, people criticizing her, I think, is ridiculous, because it's not about her being the best. She was just ambitious. And give her credit, because she did things on her own terms. And she also tried to be an inspiration for women and let them know, don't let people tell you what you are or what you can't be. Live your dreams. Aspire for more. And it's people like Amelia that I think have done wonders for people around the world who otherwise might not have thought about giving their dreams a chance. That's my takeaway on this, is that she truly is an inspiration, and she was a skilled pilot, and hence why she's the only female pilot you and I can name.
Yeah.
And not that we're into planes, but
she's the only pilot I can name.
Well, I know there's Charles Lindbergh, and of course people would call her Lady Lindbergh or Lady Lindy, but I don't know if that's fair because she wanted to do things as Amelia Earhart, not Charles Lindbergh, not Lady Lindy. So.
Exactly.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.